Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Friday, August the 3rd, and I'm Alok Jha. This is News Desk from Guardian Unlimited. British soldiers in combat zones are facing increasing mental health problems, alcoholism and family breakdown, say scientists. Russia has staked its claim on a large chunk of the Arctic, and therefore the oil underneath it, by planting a flag 2.5 miles underwater. There's a new gold rush in California. We speak to some modern prospectors. We take you on a rare tour of a US missile base in the Yorkshire Dales. And holidays from hell. According to the Foreign Office, Brits are most likely to find trouble in places such as Thailand, Australia, Greece and India. We ask why. And of course, Roz Taylor will be here to take us through the day's papers. Soldiers on active duty are facing escalating mental health problems, according to a new study in the British Medical Journal. Scientists found that prolonged periods of combat were linked to post-traumatic stress and family breakdown. I asked Polly Curtis for more.
What they did was they traced 5,500 military personnel, so that's people in the Navy, the Army and the Royal Air Force, who had been deployed at some point in the 3 years previous to being surveyed. So this was all people who had experience in combat in the field within 3 years. And they asked them, they use kind of standard measures of mental health to assess whether they have post-traumatic stress disorders, whether they were drinking too much, whether what kind of physical impact it was having on them, and what kind of effect being in combat was having on their general levels of anxiety.
And what kinds of problems were the soldiers facing then?
What they were measuring was whether exceeding the government's guidelines on how long people should spend in combat was having detrimental effects. So the government has these harmony guidelines, which suggest that people shouldn't spend more than 13 months deployed within a 3-year period. So they were measuring what happens once people went above that level. And they found that if you spent more than 13 months deployed in the previous 3 years, you were very more likely to have a severe drinking problem. You were markedly more likely to have post-traumatic stress disorder, higher levels of general anxiety. And quite interestingly, you were also more likely to have problems at home with your family, so problems with your partner, with your children, financial problems, which suggested that military personnel aren't getting support at home they need when they're away from their families.
So what do these researchers recommend that the government does?
Well, the worst problems were among people who were deployed, told they were going home, and then that date was later revised. So they either didn't know when they were going home, or they were deployed for longer than they thought, so their families didn't know when they were coming home. So these researchers suggest that it's actually really, really important that when people are sent out to fight wars, that they know when they're going to go home and see their families again.
How have people reacted to this? I mean, this is quite a political issue in some respects.
Well, it is, because there is this row over whether our armed forces are overstretched at the moment, with select committees saying that they are, and in particular, obviously, opposition MPs saying that they are. So the Liberal Democrats were last night saying that it was another argument to withdraw from Iraq because of the pressure that Iraq and Afghanistan are putting on the forces and causing the overstretch. So, yeah, clearly it's all got very political.
That was health correspondent Polly Curtis. Roz Taylor's here now with the papers. Roz, postmasters are being blackmailed, according to the Daily Mail.
Very strong leads in the Mail and Telegraph today, which say that postmasters all around the country have received a letter from one of their managers telling them that they have to follow the proper line to take when the public ask them about post office closures. In other words, are you going to be closed down? And if they don't, they risk losing their compensation payments if their post office does end up being closed down. The Mail has very, very strong words to describe what's going on here. Bullying, mental torture, spying, the only thing missing is the midnight knock on the door. Astonishing campaign of intimidation of which the Stasi would be proud.
Sounds horrible. Chris Langham, the actor, has also been convicted in his case.
Chris Langham has been convicted of downloading violent images of child abuse, and these are Category 5 images, which are the worst kind, and that means he will certainly be sentenced to a number of years in jail. We don't know how long yet, because he was convicted yesterday, but he's still away awaiting sentence. The judge basically remanded him in custody for his own protection, I think. He was, however, acquitted of the charges against him, which were of sleeping with a girl of 14. And there is a lot of comment about this girl in today's papers. The prosecution portrayed her as a mixed-up, sweet, naive girl, the Times says. The defence, on the other hand, said she was a liar and an attention-seeking fantasist. It should probably be pointed out that Chris Langham says he did sleep with her, but she was 18 at the time.
Moving on to the IPCC report, this is the investigation into the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menezes. All the papers have this.
All the papers do have this, and a lot of them have quite a harsh verdict on Sir Ian Blair, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner. He was the guy in charge at the time of the shooting, and it says that they say that he has basically got off pretty mildly in this report. The person who has been made a scapegoat is his assistant commissioner, Heyman, and in fact the Times cartoon shows Heyman as a small goat being held in a lead by Sir Ian Blair at a police parade. The Times in particular says that Sir Ian ought to have had a better idea of what was going on July the 22nd, which was the day of shooting. The report says that he had no idea for a long time that the wrong man had been shot in Stockwell Tube, and that was why he misled the press at press conferences during the time.
Let's finish off with something a bit lighter, The Sun, and something about pinching bottoms.
Indeed. You may have heard the recent story about a Channel 4 reporter who had her bottom pinched, was goosed when she was doing a live broadcast during the floods, and the guy who did it was cautioned by the police. The Sun has been very worried about this because it basically thinks that we all ought to be able to pinch each other's bottoms at any time, at any place, but given the legal restraints on doing so, it has written what it calls a pre-ruptial agreement, which you're entitled to fill in, and it grants formal consent for one pinch of my backside at an undisclosed time over the next 24 hours.
I'm certainly not going to be signing that. Roz, thank you very much. You can get the wrap delivered to you, details at guardian.co.uk/wrap. Russia has laid claim to billions of dollars worth of oil and gas reserves in the Arctic Ocean. Two mini-submarines reached the seabed, which is more than 2.5 miles under the North Pole, and planted a 1-metre-high Russian flag there. I asked Tom Parfit whether this was really the way countries claim land nowadays.
Well, I think the short answer is no, to be honest. What the Russians are trying to do is prove that the underwater Lomonosov Ridge, which is under the North Pole, is the same geological makeup as its own continental shelf in the Arctic Ocean. But even if it manages to do that, then that won't be the be-all and end-all, because there'll need to be all sorts of other data like depth soundings and so on in order to prove that Russia has a claim to this territory, and it will need to be approved by the United Nations, which judges on these things.
Why are the Russians doing this? What's under there?
Well, the principal reason, of course, is the fact that the Arctic Ocean has absolutely massive reserves of oil and natural gas. Some experts put that at about 10 billion tons of hydrocarbons. In the seabed there in the Arctic Ocean. So there's really a race now for those energy riches, and Russia clearly wants to be part of it.
How much land is at stake here, and how difficult is it going to be to actually extract the hydrocarbons?
We're talking about 1.2 million square kilometres of underwater territory. That's about 460,000 square miles, so it's an enormous area, and clearly as the ice cap is melting, it's becoming easier to carry out exploration in the far north, but it will still be a huge challenge in terms of the amount of money that will be needed, the difficulty of exploring for oil and gas and drilling there. And it's obviously a kind of development that will face quite a lot of protests from environmentalists who think it will only increase greenhouse gas emissions and so on.
So what happens now? The Russians are still there in their submersibles, but what will they have to prove to the other nations, and how likely is it that their claim is going to be upheld?
Well, they'll have to now submit the results of their experiments of the sediment and the water which they collected from the bottom of the ocean to the United Nations. And then the UN will rule on whether they have a valid claim to extending their territory from the continental shelf right out to this Lomonosov Ridge, which runs across the polar region. One Norwegian expert yesterday was saying that it would be easy enough to prove that the Appalachians and the mountains in Scotland are the same geological formation, because the United States and Europe used to be connected. But that doesn't mean that Scotland can suddenly lay claim to the United States. The Russians will need to find a whole raft of other data in order to back up their claim if they're going to have any chance of the UN approving it and giving them this massive new area of territory.
That was Tom Parfit in Moscow. The gold rush is back in California. Today's gold seekers may not have the reputation of the legendary prospectors back in the mid-18th century, but they're a no less eclectic bunch, drawn by the lure of sparkling flakes found in the riverbeds in California. Dan Glaister joins some modern-day prospectors in the Angeles National Forest.
The last 20 years, Bernie McGrath has been living in a campervan parked in the Angeles National Forest. Bernie is one of a rare breed, a gold prospector. But today's gold prospectors are a far cry from the 49ers, the celebrated pioneers of the original California gold rush in the middle of the 19th century. For Bernie, he's attracted not so much by the possibility of endless riches as the opportunity to lead a quiet life close to nature, albeit one with the constant drone of the generator powering his small sluice in the background.
I moved up here, and my intentions was to go fishing all the time. But after a while, going fishing all day long is a pain in the ass. And one morning, a guy was up there sniping on rocks. He asked me what time it was. I said, 20 after 11. And I said, what are you doing? Because I couldn't understand what he had there. He says, I'm looking for gold.
Rick Martin, a car salesman from Riverside County, is one of several regulars who travel to the bend in the river that Bernie has made his home.
Can you just describe for me what you're doing here?
Just shaking up the concentrates to where all the heaviness, all the heavy sands and gold, if any, will go to the bottom, and then the light stuff comes to the top. I'm just taking a wave in and a wave out and a little bit of material out with it as I go. And once the black sand starts showing up again, shake it again. Get all the heavies back to the bottom. Pull out some of your big rocks, make sure they're not a nugget. That wouldn't be good.
A light-hearted camaraderie pervades the group gathered at the riverbank, but all eyes are on Bernie. He is the one with the knowledge both of the river and the gold. After a few minutes panning the residue left by his sluice, Bernie finds what they are all looking for.
Damn, Bernie, when'd you get that?
Wow!
Huh?
That's now. It's going nice. I love it, don't you? That's a few pickers right there.
There it is.
What sort of size are those? Well, how would you quantify those?
I drop it, makes the noise. It's a picker.
I mean, you can pick it up, you know?
Yeah, I don't have to go.
You need tweezers to pick it up, it's not a picker.
Dan Glaister reporting there. From Los Angeles now to the Yorkshire Dales. Normally it's just an area of outstanding natural beauty, but it's also home to the American anti-missile system. Our intrepid reporter Martin Wainwright was allowed access to the facility.
This is Martin Wainwright for Guardian Unlimited from one of the most secretive military bases in the United Kingdom, RAF Filing Dales, which is where the early warning of potential missile attack is coordinated with an enormous radar, which is a feature of the North York Moors National Park. Anybody who's been to Scarborough or Whitby or to see the heather, which is coming out at this time of the year, will be familiar with it. It's in the news at the moment, controversially, because later this month, a very expensive multi-million pound upgrade, which has been taking place over the last couple of years, finally opens and links Filingdales into the United States new defence system against missile attack by what they call rogue states. And there's been a bit of an uproar because MPs have gone on their holidays and have not had time to discuss this. Anyway, possibly as a response to this, Filingdales opened its doors today and welcomed us in through perimeter fences of barbed wire coils, razor wire, and finally, in the last perimeter, an electric fence, and showed us the works. I'm with Wing Commander Nicky Loveday, who's the station commander here. Nicky, like everybody else who drives from Pickering to Whitby across the moors, you pass it, or I pass this big sort of cheese grater thing, and you think, what spooky things are they doing in there? What are you doing?
The roles of the station are to provide missile warning of attacks against the continental United States, Northern Europe and the United Kingdom, to contribute to the space surveillance and to provide a satellite warning service global and to our own armed forces.
The tie-in with the Americans is obviously strong. I noticed in the operations room the clock is showing, is it Mount Cheyenne time? Cheyenne Mountain time. But I've not... Where are all the Americans? I haven't met a single one.
We just have a single American United States Air Force liaison officer, and he represents the 50% share that the US has in the radar. And I think what it says very clearly is that the United States trusts the United Kingdom to operate the radar at Farlingdales in the best interests of both nations.
But, and I know you can't talk politics, but I noticed in the very good little audiovisual display you gave us, there was a simulation of an enemy missile coming, and I did notice it had a big red star on. And as we know, the Russians aren't very happy about the Americans sighting the thing, similar thing to Farlingdales in Czechoslovakia. Are you going to change your little drawing?
I think, yes, I hadn't spotted that myself, but we will, because obviously the ballistic missile defence system is not designed to defend against responsible states with established strategic nuclear forces. It's designed to protect against limited threats from states of concern. So definitely Russia is not seen as a threat, and it's certainly not designed to offend the Russians by having a red star, and I will have that amended.
And people may be interested to know that they can come here, they're welcome here. Can you just tell me about that? I mean, if somebody thinks I'd like to go and have a look, what do they do?
Contact the station, or either our media and comms officer or our regional press officer. We have open evenings every Tuesday throughout the summer months, and we welcome in local groups primarily, but anybody is welcome to ask to come and visit Farlingdales, and we'd be very glad to host you.
Lovely. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Nicky. Thank you.
The invitation to visit Farlingdales is one I think well worth taking up. On my way back to Leeds, I stopped at the nearest pub to the base, the Fox and Rabbit at Lockton, and had a beer and a sandwich, and just looking round at the holidaymakers on their way to Whitby, I was thinking, well, isn't it extraordinary that about a mile from here, men in that underground bunker, men and women in that underground bunker, are watching 24 hours for possible missile attack, something that we take for granted, and that it would be a very good thing, I think, if more of us knew and took advantage of the offer to find out what goes on there, how they do it, and why they do it.
The incomparable Martin Wainwright there, reporting from a windy Yorkshire Dales. Brits abroad are most likely to find trouble in some surprisingly pleasant places, says a new list of the most dangerous destinations from the Foreign Office. Here's Stuart Jeffries with more.
Amazingly, the most dangerous place is Thailand, and one of the reasons for that is because so many Britons go there completely unprepared for what they're likely to experience in terms of it's frighteningly deadly. You're more likely to die in Thailand as a British tourist than any other country in the
world.
Doing
what, though? Well, what is it? Is it animals? Is it drugs? What?
All of the above. All of the above. I mean, you know, to be perfectly honest, it's also true that the figures released by the Foreign Office cover deaths and doesn't break them down into murders or anything like that. So quite a lot of those deaths will be elderly British people who've retired there dying of natural causes. But there are lots of other deaths from things like traffic accidents. They're quite horrible. People getting drowned in overladen boats and things like that.
And straight after Thailand, though, surprisingly, is Australia. I mean, this is a place that thousands of Brits go to every month, drink beer, and what's dangerous about Australia?
That's the problem, exactly that. Britons go there, think it's like England, or think it's like Britain, and don't take sufficient precautions, don't realise that when they're in the outback, particularly, they're in quite a wild climate, full of wildlife which is quite destructive to them. And they also don't... these figures also say that Australia is dangerous because, not for deadly reasons, but also because of other reasons like losing passports and getting into trouble that way. It's also a country where there have been lots of quite high-profile murders of British backpackers. And when I was speaking to ABTA, the Association of British Travel Agents, yesterday, they were saying that, in fact, Britons don't prepare very well when they go there. They lose their passports, they don't think about the climate particularly, and they don't think about the risk that they're going to be facing out there.
And then back further afield, it's India. I mean, this is a place place we normally associate with romantic sort of getaways in Goa and that kind of thing. And what's dangerous about there?
Well, there have been several murders there of Britons. Again, you know, British retirees have been murdered in the lovely resort of Goa, bizarrely enough. But oddly, one of the most interesting parts of why it's dangerous to go to India is because Britons of Indian ancestry will go there thinking that they're immune to various diseases, like malaria. They'll go thinking that they're immune to malaria. It turns out they're not, so they'll often wind up hospitalised and spending a lot of money on hospital bills.
The other two in the top five were Greece and Czech Republic. I mean, I can assume that Greece has its fair share of sort of over tanned people or dying of heat exhaustion and that kind of thing. Is that the kind of thing that that they're talking about?
There's a lot of flip-flop wearing, safety helmet is stewing, Retsina charged Britons on mopeds, and those cause a lot of hospitalised, accidents that involve hospital treatment. It's also bizarre that in the period covered by the Foreign Office report, there were 48 rapes in Greece, which is an extraordinary figure. Mm. But most of the problems abroad for British tourists, according to ABTA again, are because of the faults of Britons being drunk. And
I was going to say, it sounds like that, doesn't it? It sounds like our own stupidity rather than anything dangerous about those countries.
And that's certainly what the Czech police say. We are causing all the problems. We're responsible. Britons on stag tours are responsible for 20% of weekend crime in Prague. And we are a danger to ourselves.
The Czechs must love us. Stuart, what do you make of this survey then? I mean, does it mean that I'm going to have to avoid Australia, India, Greece and Thailand from now on?
Well, it's worth saying that the Foreign Office doesn't consider places like Iraq and Afghanistan worthy of reporting because they're not actually as
holiday destinations.
They're not holiday destinations, obviously. But I think the thing is, a lot of Britons go to these countries, and that's why statistically Britons are more likely to be in danger in those places. Mm. But you know, if you now go to Liberia, I should imagine you're more likely to get into trouble in Liberia than if you go, say, to Prague for the weekend.
So, weekend trips to Prague still on, everyone. Thanks a lot, Stuart. And that's it for today and this week. You'll be pleased to know that your regular presenter, John Dennis, is back next week. But you can hear me every Monday in the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, where we take you through the week's science news in the most stylish way possible. Next week, we talk to Amnesty International's Kate Allen. She'll be telling us about how technology is a key part of the fight for human rights around the world. And there might even be a bit of the guitar hero, Brian May. This programme was produced by Mike Gandon and Phil Maynard. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.